Hello there, and you're very welcome to the programme. Wishy Fogarty, with you as usual. Now, if you have even the slightest interest in Irish rugby, the name Brent Pope will immediately come to mind, because he is the RT rugby analyst who lights up our screens in the company of one George Hook when all the big rugby games are televised by RT. So, who is this New Zealander with the vast knowledge of Irish rugby affairs? Let's find out. Brent Pope, you're very welcome to Radio Kerry and to the Kingdom.
Cheers, thanks very much.
Nice to have you.
Oh no, it's brilliant. So I've only been here once before, so it's nice to return. I was here about 12 years ago. My father came over, my brother, so we did the kind of, I suppose, the touristy thing in those days, the Ring of Kerry and whatever. But it's great to be back. I mean, I love the people down here. It's brilliant.
So what brings you to Kerry now?
We're down here just on a sort of property expo. I'm involved. I was a property valuer in New Zealand before I ever sort of came over to do the rugby stint. So I've just gone back to that work. She's just developing properties out in Bulgaria. So it was sort of a roadshow that goes around the country. So anybody looking at Bulgarian properties, pop down. We're in one of the hotels down here.
I must say that when I sit down, the first time I ever saw you on TV, and you're actually working, you're working, I suppose, with RT about
10 years.
10 years are you?
10 years, 1995.
I must say, the first thing that came to my mind when I saw you sitting down, I said, what is a New Zealander doing analysing Irish rugby affairs? But you have a good Irish background.
I do, yeah. My relations, I suppose, my roots come from Tipperary there. So as I've always meant to get back, as I wasn't brought up Irish, I'd be wrong to say I was. But I mean, it's nice to have that association. So when I go back to Limerick, we're going on from here to Limerick, then I'll pop down through Adair or whatever and go around to Ballygran there or whatever and see where the homestead is or whatever. So I've an Irish passport, and some people say I'm more Irish than the Irish themselves, but the first TV program, I think I was due to go home, and they rang me at the time. I think RT rang me and said, would I come on and do the Ireland were playing New Zealand 1995 World Cup. So I was only going in for the day, and then I was going to fly back to New Zealand the next day. And things went brilliant in those days. The panel, say, Bill O'Hurley and your own Mick Doyle were here, and say, we had great fun. And I mean, I stayed on for that whole programme, and ever since that, luckily enough, I've been a kind of fixture. So I've seen them come and go, including Mr. Hook, who joined me about 6 or 7 years ago. And I say, the panel is great. It's great crack. I mean, we have a great, we've sort of a bit of a cult following now. I mean, I know the Sky's there and the BBC, but people like to tune in to see if George and I are having a go each other, which we regularly do.
There's an O'Brien name in your family, isn't there?
Yeah, my great grandparents was Morgan O'Brien, his brother Jeremiah, and he married Leela Chalk. So I mean, the Chalks are a pretty big name, and the O'Briens, especially in Limerick, and they were horse breeders. So they immigrated to New Zealand and then had a pretty esteemed background in New Zealand. They were good breeders, and there was a big article. I think Morgan Jr. The O'Brien's name is kept on, but Morgan Jr. And there was big stuff about he was involved in discovering a double murder or something lived in his hotel. There's a big, we still have all the cutting, I still have all the old photographs of the family tree and sort of thing, but at that time a sort of a double murder in New Zealand, and the guy was staying under his very roof, and Morgan O'Brien Jr. owned a hotel, I think, in Oamaru in the South Island, New Zealand, and he was living under his very roof.
So are there dark secrets in the family?
Dark secrets. I don't know whether I should be saying that, but at the time, you know, now it's common enough now, unfortunately, that you get killings and that, but in those days in New Zealand, especially the other side of the world, that was huge news, and he actually discovered them, and I think he turned them into the police, so there was all this Irishman Morgan O'Brien. But my mother would still be very, and you know, she would keep in touch with sort of parish priests or relations that are over here, so I must go back. I've always promised them I'd go back and kind of search around the family tree and say go to the homestead and that. I just, sometimes you feel a bit embarrassed, you know. I wasn't brought up Irish, so sometimes I think, you know, I don't have a right to, in a sense, but I do really. But
you were born in Ashburn in the South Island in New Zealand.
Yeah, a little rural town, about 9,000 people. Yeah. Had a great upbringing, born off farming stock. So I was spent my life shearing and hay carting and all that sort of thing. And then I was lucky enough, I suppose I was always quite good at rugby, and in a sense I didn't know it because it was a small country town, and you know, even though everybody loved rugby, I then was lucky enough to go up to Canterbury, which is Christchurch, and go up there to study at university, and then sort of the rugby career went from there. But so it's lovely. I love the rural, so, and that's why even coming down here, rural people are sometimes a bit different. I've lived in a lot of cities around the world, and I still like the sort of, I suppose, the down-to-earth approach of country people.
I must say, I visited New Zealand with the Kerry team in 1970, and we went to Australia, and we played in a place called Wagga Wagga in Australia, and went on to New Zealand. And the one thing that we noticed, and All the young kids from 5, 6, 7 up along, they were all handling the rugby ball.
Yeah.
So while Gaelic football and hurling would be our national games, as you know here, talk to us, Brent, about how it is inbred into them in New Zealand, because the All Blacks, the whole thing is fascinating from a sportsman's point of view.
Yeah, well, it's the same. I always equate, and I quite often use the comparisons between GAA over here and rugby. And the one criticism I've always felt, even coaching over here and playing here when I arrived, is that rugby players don't put enough time into the skills of the game. And we saw that on Saturday, evident in the match, that the All Blacks, while they probably were similar in physique or whatever, and that they just had this different level of ball skills. You had props handling, kicking off both feet.
Yeah, ball handling was absolutely stunning.
Brilliant. And the kicking off both feet. And if you see the South Sea Islanders, especially the Polynesians, they'll play with a bladder, they'll play with an old rolled up sock. I mean, even myself, I remember going out in the backyard and you'd play down the hallways and everything. But it was always skills first. Unfortunately, the rugby players over here, and I often equate to the GAA, say, look, I'll drive past a lot of fields, even in Dublin, and see a guy out with a hurler or whatever, and he's practicing. You know, the GAA guys are kicking balls. You don't see many of it in rugby. They all want to run before they can walk, and that's more the shame. And I think it's really something that they've got to go back to at grassroots level over here, is get the skills first. Don't worry how much you can bench press or how quick you can run the 100 metres. That'll all come in time. Practice the skills. I remember Dave Kirk, who captained New Zealand the 1987 World Cup. I remember he couldn't pass well off his bad hand, which is his left, passing left to right. He tired. I remember him used to hook a hand in the belt of his trousers and pass a ball up against the garage 100 times before he went off to school every day or university. And that's the kind of dedication you need to become an All Black. It's practicing your skills. And too many Irish players, international players even, if you went out and said, look, pass off your bad hand or kick off your bad foot, they couldn't do it because they're not bothered to practice, whereas the GAA guys are, you know.
You played schoolboy and you played with your province, Otago.
Yeah.
And talk to us about your own young rugby life now growing up and how far you went. I think did you get an international trial?
I know a lot of them. You know, I said I come from a small area. I went to play then rugby for Canterbury, the province Canterbury, which was one of the strongest. Actually, there's a great story if you've got 2 minutes. In my first game, I remember I was a crowd of about 60,000 people, and there's a great All Black flanker named Jock Hobbs. I was in the subs bench for him, and in those days the commentators were on the sideline. If you remember yourself, they'd have the microphone, and they were on the sideline, and I was asked to go down to the side of the pitch and warm up. And I suppose I was only about 17 years of age, and I puffed my chest out. I thought this is going to be the greatest day of my rugby career. And he came off, and I burst on past the commentator, and he looked down at the program, and he said, remember saying, number 7, Jock Hobbs, replaced by 17, Bent Pipe. So I thought, how's that for your ego? I just went downhill, but...
No, Brent, this is a dangerous thing to be telling the listeners, because every time we look at you on television, we'll say, that Bent Pipe?
But you can imagine, you're thinking everybody's going to know your name, and I burst on, and he was looking over the top of his glasses. He was an older guy, and he said, replaced by Bent Pipe. But, then I played nearly 100 times for Otago in the First Division. We won the National Championship. I played for the South Island.
What position did you play?
I played 6, 7, or 8, but usually 8. And I had about 3 or 4 All Black trials, and I made the 87 World Cup squad, which was unfortunate because they won it. And then,
but you missed
last
out.
Last match.
Tell us about what happened that you missed out at, because you missed out winning a World Cup medal.
Well, it's always something that'll go down pretty hard with me. But I mean, swings and roundabouts, as they say in Ireland, I've moved over here. But it was the last minute of the game, and ironically enough, I just won the Player of the Day award. You know, they give the player the match. I just won that on the loudspeaker. It come over and I was rabbiting for the try line, and I think I got my arm stuck behind the posts of all things. It was quite a horrific accident. And if you imagine my arm being straight, it was bent behind the post, and another player dived in, and I dislocated my elbow, and I broke my arm at about 6 places, because it was like the only other one they'd seen, like it was a hang glider who had gone into the side of a cliff and he put his hand out to stop himself, because it's an unusual way to dislocate your elbow. It went out the back, and it stayed out for about 3 hours. So they flew me to Auckland Hospital and operated then, but that was it. They rang the hospital that night, and I was out. And of course, the guy that came in won Zinzan Brook, He was away playing in Auckland. Didn't know he was in the setup, and they gave him a call, and he got called in.
Strange enough, now that you brought up Zen Brooks' name, he was in Killarney lately.
Yeah,
and he did a big fundraising for two girls that had gone out to Brazil, and I had him on my program.
Yeah.
And himself and a group of New Zealanders did the haka inside in the foyer of the Great Southern Hotel here in Killarney just a few months ago. Small world.
He loves it over here. I know Zinny well, you know. And, of course, his brothers were playing over here. I think one of his brothers, younger brother, played down around this area, certainly in Munster, played club rugby. But Zinzan's a big GAA man, as is the McCahills. From Ireland. But another funny story, a friend of my brother was a teacher at a school called St. Pat Silverstream, and a Catholic boys' school in Wellington, and they always had an exchange with an Irish teacher. And a guy, Donal O'Brien, came over, actually the same name, Donal O'Brien came over from living just out of Dublin, and they asked him, now, if you saw Donal, he'd be about 7 stone dripping wet. You know, and they said, would he like to play for the Wellington GAA side?
Yeah.
So he thought this was great. I mean, his only foray into physical sport was, you think he represented the Irish chess side or something like that, was the sort of physique we're talking about. Well, he came home that night and he got into a bath. He was black and blue because Zinzan Book was playing, Bernie McKay was playing, Robin Book was playing.
Gaelic.
They were in the Auckland Gaelic side. Of course, Donal thought just because he knew the rules, he'd be good at it.
Yeah.
And they bet him up and down the park, and he said he's never going back to play, you know.
Before we go on talking about your own career, it's just come to my mind. Have you watched Australians playing Ireland?
My rules. Yeah, I've been twice, yeah. I've been to those matches. Yeah, I love them.
You've been to them?
I've been to them, yeah.
No.
Yeah.
The last one that was played here, the whole of Ireland was in uproar about what happened.
Yeah.
And now talk to us about your view on compromise rules and your view on the game that we saw lately when we saw all that violence. We call it violence.
Yeah, well, it was violent. I like the compromise rules, and I mean, a few of the GAA people would be putting their heads in the pillow about now. I like it from a New Zealand or Australia standpoint. I mean, I grew up grew up watching a bit of Aussie rules. I'd lived in Australia for a year, so I saw a bit of the Aussie rules. And then I came over here, and I liked the GAA, and I knew a lot of guys played GAA, because a lot of them came down to play for rugby clubs. You know, they play the GAA in the off-season, come down. So I like the fact that there was some physical rather than the scrag tackling, I like the fact that there was some forms of rugby in the GAA. And I remember a couple of years ago up in Croke Park going to the final. I thought Ireland won that particular compromise series, but I thought it was a cracking game, because when a lot of the GAA players used to come along to rugby training, when I was coaching even Clontarf from the north side of Dublin, or even St Mary's, we'd get a lot of GAA guys who had played at a pretty good level. But they always found it quite hard, even working on the bags, you know. And I mean, I know now that some of the GAA teams train like that. They use the tackle bags at the rugby to get that physical approach, the shoulder charges and that. I just think what happened in the last one was probably unnecessary. You know, I suppose it's a bit like the spear tackling in the rugby now. I mean, Australians, South Africans, New Zealanders, I suppose they're known for their physical approach to rugby and now to GAA. And I mean, a lot of the GAA heads around the country are saying, well, look, we'll put a few boys in next time, that'll sort that out, you know, especially a few from the north. But yeah, it was unnecessary.
Is there a future for it, Brent, do you think?
I don't know. It's a bit of a novelty game at this stage, isn't it? I mean, you know, they put the test series in. I don't think the rules really favour anybody, and I think it's sort of, you know, you're falling between two stools. I know they have to try to make the rules different, because of course the Australians are not used to having a goalkeeper. They're not used to around ball that's an oval ball. It bounced a lot different. Then again, the Irish aren't used to the kind of the hard tackling, I suppose, that they get. Over here, you can be checked and you can be sort of, I suppose, scragged above the waist, but you certainly don't have to take the hits. And if you look at the kind of physiques, the Irish are probably built a slightly different to the Australians. I mean, the Australians are more powerfully built in that sense. Yes, there are a lot of powerfully built Irish players over here that they could send over, and that's
fair to say that the Irish rugby internationals are built different than to the All Blacks. I heard yourself and George Hook discussing this on television there last week. You were talking about the physical makeup. Now, we're going all over the place because we could stay talking all day, as the fellow says. But the different
builds.
Can you ever see Ireland? I can't ever see Ireland reaching the same standard as the All Blacks and rugby.
No, I think because, I mean...
Why?
Because it's not your national sport. And you talk about GAA, the passion. You see, there's probably people that would rather go to Croke Park than go down Lansdowne Road. They would rather represent their county in football or hurling than play for Ireland. I mean, the difference is, if you take that and equate that to New Zealand, the opposite is there. Everybody wants to play. When you're 5 or 6 years of age, all you want to play be as an All Black. Your posters around the room are all Blacks. Your idols are All Black. I mean, the All Black coach, whether you like to see it or not, is probably more well-known than the Prime Minister of the country. I mean, that's how passionate New Zealanders are. That is the one thing we have. You know, we have the haka, we have the All Blacks. I mean, the All Blacks are known the world over. It's a huge marketing thing for New Zealand. Yes, we have the tourism now, really, over the last couple of years because of Lord of the Rings and these other things. But really, it's what we're known for. You know, sailing, I suppose, and the All Blacks rugby side. So in that sense, Ireland is not, and whether you like it or not, rugby, while it's increased a lot, is still not going to take over from GAA and soccer. It still will probably remain the third sport for as long as we can see. Having said that, the money side of things, I suppose, is a bit of a bone of contention. I mean, a few GAA players probably thinking, hold on, there's the likes of Brian O'Driscoll, Gordon Darcy, these guys making huge amounts of money in endorsements and salary, and here am I taking up a part-time job and going to training 5 nights a week, and you know.
What's the financial position in New Zealand in relation to rugby? Rugby, of course, is your national past, your national sport there.
Yeah.
What's the financial situation?
Oh, very good.
Talk to us about who's making money out of it. Talk to us about where the money is going. And talk to us about how big is the money.
Well, the money is big in relation to the average working man's salary. I mean, you know, you look at some of the top All Blacks, the Tana Umangas, the Richie McCaw. I mean, I don't know what they're on, but I mean, if you put it in relation to the average industrial wage or the average sort of blue collar worker, I mean, probably quite a nice lifestyle. In fact, they are the new rich. You know, you drive around some of the suburbs, say of Auckland or Christchurch, they'll say there's John Olomu's house or there's somebody else's house, and they're lovely. I mean, where New Zealand's problem lies, I suppose, is in Japan, because the real money is to be made in Japan. Some of the New Zealand rugby players could make, you know, sort of upwards of $1 million New Zealand dollars a season. They do 2 or 3 years in Japan. Not only that, the Japanese are very kind people as far as setting up business interests are concerned. So that's where New Zealand loses a lot of its top players. We've often been criticised, and I don't think people understand a lot about the New Zealand situation. A lot of people say, oh, well, you've got Fijians, you've got Samoans, you've got, you know, these people all playing for New Zealand. And while that is true to a certain degree, we are the melting pot of kind of Pacific Island. I mean, these people come to work. You know, you get a guy like Joe Rokothoko, his father may be Maori, his mother may be Fijian. People don't understand them. They think that people are going to the islands and poaching players, when, in fact, that's not really the case. I mean, a lot of these are mixed marriages. A lot of them would have, you know, a lot of the names like, you know, Piri Wipu, Tana Umanga, these guys, you know, may be of Maori as much as Samoan extraction. But going back to the physiques, I mean, it's just genetically the Polynesian people. I mean, they're huge. At 12 or 13 years of age, they're full-grown men. I mean, and they're what a lot of people call limbs men. They've huge limbs, they've huge arms, they've huge thighs. And, you know, I mean, look at John Olomu.
Yeah, you mentioned that man, John Olomu, to us now. Talk to us about him now. What's his situation at the moment?
He's back,
playing. And tell our listeners exactly what happened to him and how great he was. And how you talk to us about how you rate him.
Well, I rate him as one of the best ever. And I mean, some people say, oh yeah, you go back to the great days of Welsh rugby and the Gerald Davies and these guys. And yes, that may be true, but anybody on the rugby field that can sort of bring the marketability he brought to rugby. I mean, even yourself, any person, sports person around the world knows who John Olomu is. Doesn't matter whether you're with the New England Patriots in the US, whether you're in China or something, his draw to rugby was huge. He was a freak. In that regard, you're talking about a guy that can cover the 100 metres in a kind of a qualifying time for the Olympics, and yet at his playing weight, he was 18 and 19 stone. I mean, height. He was unstoppable. Height about 6'5". I mean, unstoppable in that position. Unstoppable as a number eight, but certainly unstoppable as a winger. I mean, people say, okay, he had defensive lapses. Well, he's not going to be the perfect player, especially at that sort of strength. But, I mean, I think we all remember that day when England thought they were going to have him sussed in the World Cup. And, of course, he ran over top of Underwood and then over Mike Capp. But what we don't know is that John Olomu was only playing about 70% of his ability, which is scary to think if he played at 100%. He had a rare kidney disease.
Was he born with this, Brent?
He was born with it, yeah. And, I mean, it was very debilitating for him. Now, having said that, John Olamu is a lovely, lovely man. I mean, he's a very quiet, shy, reserved type of guy. And, I mean, he finds public speaking and public address very difficult. And he was the type of guy that, while a lot of people criticised him for being a bit of a lazy trainer or, you know, the type of guy that couldn't go 80 minutes, it was because of this illness. And that's the kind of sad thing that I suppose coaches look back and say, oh, we pushed John to the extent that it was just about breaking point. But, I mean, breaking point for him was, you know, 30, 40% less than anybody else. But in his heyday, an absolute phenomenon. He's back playing for Cardiff now, trying to force his way into the All Blacks for the next World Cup. I don't think it's going to happen, sadly, for rugby. And, I mean, I think it's a nice thing that a guy is not sitting back on his laurels. He's not retiring and saying, oh, I wasn't the greatest. He probably, in some books, he's making a mistake because people want to remember.
You reckon he won't reach no, that peak again?
No, he won't. I can't see it. His physique has changed a bit. He's a bit more puffy around the face. He doesn't look to have that same sort of cut frame he has. Yes, he'll be great for the game, and yes, he'll put bums on seats in Cardiff, but I don't think he'll force himself back into the New Zealand game. And what I love about it, I suppose, that John Olamu, if he was sitting here now, he would say he just wants to play rugby for the love of the game. You know, he doesn't really care that he'll be remembered for a great or not. He wants to keep
some
playing.
Sight when he was in action.
Unbelievable.
Unbelievable. Big loss to rugby.
Huge loss. I remember coming back, I was in Zambrook. I was coming back on a flight from in 1995 after that World Cup when New Zealand lost. I was coming back on a flight through South Africa for Ireland. And I said to someone, I hadn't met John Olamu, hadn't seen him in the flesh, and I said, you know, just how big is this guy? And they said, well, have a look, he's coming down the aisle of the plane. Well, I'd never seen anything like it. At that stage, because he likes the old Kentucky Fried Chicken, and at that stage, after the tournament, his playing weight would have been around about the 19 stone, and we're talking ripped, you know, what we call cut and muscular. He had ballooned to about 22 stone. And, I mean, even then, you couldn't see where the weight had gone, but 22 stone. And, I mean, it's all in his thighs. And, jeez, I saw this guy coming down. I
freak of nature, was he?
A freak. And a guy that can move like the wind at that. I mean, you couldn't. Unstoppable.
Who was the greatest rugby player you ever saw?
The greatest, well, different reasons, I suppose. You know, I was lucky to play in an era of great rugby players.
So it is like, it is like asking a Kerry man who was the greatest footballer ever.
Exactly.
By the way, Kerry would be known as the All Blacks, of Gaelic football.
Oh, I know that.
Or the Manchester United of Gaelic football.
Yeah. Oh, well, I know that. I've you hear certainly enough about Kerry.
Anyway, back to the best.
But that, you know, again, you say it's oranges and apples, and there were some fantastic players playing for New Zealand. I go back to even the Lions. I remember as a school kid going down and watching the Lions come across and the likes of Mike Gibson and these and kicking a ball in a little rural town. They brought the Lions on tour. They played in Ashburton. You know, it was stacked. And looking through the railings and seeing the likes of the John Bevans, the David Duckhams, that sort of era of Lions rugby. But I suppose there's a few special people. I mean, Michael Jones, the Samoan great number seven. I played with Michael and I played against him. He was special because I think of his just nature in the game. The fact he couldn't play and he wouldn't play rugby on a Sunday cost him a lot of caps. A very genteel type of guy and a fiercely religious guy, and really started the ball rolling for all these kind of, I suppose, religious players like the Ingatuga Malas that wouldn't play on Sunday, that respected God and played for the love of the game. I mean, they were special to me, but there's too many to mention. We could be here all day mentioning great players for different reasons, but I suppose John Olamu, to me, sums up just the excitement of modern rugby. I don't think we'll see the likes of him again ever, really.
Since you've come to Ireland, who was the best Irish rugby player you ever saw?
Well, the best Irish rugby player I ever saw, I suppose, in a sense, in modern day, was Keith Wood. I mean, I think, you know, yes, you can go back to the Mike Gibsons and everybody can go back further than that to the Jackie Carls. I didn't see those guys. I saw glimpses of Tony O'Reilly, of course, in his day was another big, strong winger in the junior John Olamu mode. But I think Keith Wood, to me, probably epitomised the modern player. And I think he's the one player that, I suppose, over the last few years, apart from Brian O'Driscoll now, that the New Zealanders would have selected in their team every year. I mean, I remember somebody saying to me, they said, that Keith Wood would have put it up to Sean Fitzpatrick to make the All Blacks. And I think you can get no higher regard in world rugby than to say you would have been selected as an Irishman to play for New Zealand. I think Brian O'Driscoll is certainly reaching that standard as far as New Zealanders are concerned. He'd have been one guy that they would have penciled into a team. And I think most people look at that. How many Irish players would make the All Blacks starting 15? And, I mean, you're really, over the last few years, you're probably only looking at, realistically, I suppose, Keith Wood and now Brian O'Driscoll.
We'll talk about the Kerry rugby players later on in the interview. But you mentioned Brian O'Driscoll there. Is this spear tackle, is it gone over top altogether? I mean, for myself now, living down in Kerry, I think it's gone on a bit too long.
It has.
Talk to us about it, Brent. I mean, it seems to be going on and going on and going on and going on.
Yeah, and I keep saying to people, and people keep saying to me, oh, it's dangerous. The first thing I'd like to say is, yes, they are dangerous, reckless tackles, and they should be outlawed from the game. Absolutely. You know, no different from any other sport. We see it happen in rugby league every week. We saw it happen again on Saturday. From both parties, I'd have to say, yes, Ma Nonu, the All Black centre, has been cited for it. Shane Horgan did a similar dump tackle. It's quite hard as a rugby player to pull out of a tackle when you're through it, but there is an extent when it goes above the shoulder and the guy is in danger of breaking his neck or something coming to ground, then absolutely it should be outlawed, and the IRB should be doing something about it. The Brian O'Driscoll affair, I'll take an argument with anybody that it was premeditated. It was not premeditated. I mean, Tana Umanga and Kevin Mialamu were clearing out a ruck. Now, whether it was legally or illegally, the way that players are coached, even in the Northern Hemisphere, and especially in France and England, to clear out a ruck is, I suppose, to pinch the hamstring of the player to take him off balance so that his stability is gone. That is what they did. Unfortunately, there were two of them. And
Say that to us again. I haven't heard this term
before.
Well,
if you have a player, you imagine a strong forward or something, and he's strong on his feet, and he's clinched up. The only way you can probably get him off balance is maybe to sort of to grab him around the back of the leg, take one leg off the ground so that he loses his stability, and you can blow him out of the ruck, so to speak. That is what players are taught. That is what the way they are taught nowadays, to clear a ruck out. What happened was, unfortunately, two players did it at the same time. So, in effect, while Brian O'Driscoll should have only been one leg on the ground, one leg off, and maybe just fell ordinarily, both legs were off the ground, and it then made it be a severely dangerous tackle. And when you see it, it doesn't look good, and I admit that. And most New Zealanders, and I keep telling people on, most New Zealanders sympathise with Brian O'Driscoll. I was out there on the Lions tour. Most New Zealanders were coming up to me, I suppose, as a pseudo-Irishman, saying, look, we're very sorry this has happened. You know, Tana Umanga absolutely should have apologised first and foremost. He should have been on the phone to Brian O'Driscoll and say, look, Brian, I'm sorry. I didn't mean to do it. It's unfortunately out of the tour.
And should he?
You know, and he should have done that. He should have done that.
You reckon it was an accident?
I don't think it was an accident, because I don't think it was premeditated. And I'll tell you the difference. The difference to me is that, you know yourself, you play in GAA, you're hyped up for a big match, the adrenaline is running. You know, we've seen hurlers, we've seen GAA footballers, we've seen compromise rules.
It's happened before
exactly.
You know it.
It's yeah. Happened before you know it. It's the first time.
On the other hand, Brent, and I must bring you back, excuse me. A lot of people have said, and it was reported, that when they were lining up before the game and the All Blacks were doing the haka, that Driscoll insulted them.
No.
When he put, I want to get your view on it, because you grew up with this now and you can clear it up. And by picking up the blade of grass or whatever he did and throwing it up in the air, that he... Now, lot of talk about that. Yep. Talk to us about it.
No, he absolutely not. I mean, you know, that people want to speculate on what sort of, I suppose, riled the All Blacks. I mean, no, in fact, if you look at the history of the haka, in the haka, and any dignitary that'll arrive in New Zealand, they're throwing out a Maori challenge, which is what the haka is. And in fact, if you see kings or princes or anybody that arrives, they're actually asked to pick up something from the ground to accept the challenge. So I think that's realistic of what Brian O'Driscoll was doing. In fact, they went as far as to talk to a Maori elder. This would be one of the few Maori kind of respected people that would know about Maoridom, is what we call it in New Zealand, to how they best should respect the haka. So in fact, Brian O'Driscoll was probably doing the opposite. He was probably showing his respect. And I think what he was doing, he wasn't throwing away as if it was a throwaway thing, look, we don't care. I think he was saying that I'm accepting the Maori challenge, and I mean, that's the way that New Zealand's looked at it. There was no talk in New Zealand that Brian O'Driscoll had any way disrespected that.
But it was being said around here, wasn't it?
I was said around here.
Now, correct me if I'm wrong, and we're recording this programme on the week after the All Blacks beat Ireland with their second string, All Blacks second string in Croke Park. When they were doing the haka, just a throwaway thing, I remember, did they do the jump at the end at all?
No, the jump has kind of gone out of them. The funny thing is,
I noticed that, and it takes from it.
It does, although if you go back to the old harkers, I mean, the old harkers look like a skipped-up version of the river dance, you know what I mean? And they're all done by, I suppose, a lot of white or Caucasian people that, rather than the Islanders and the Maoris. But, I mean, no, what they do now is a few of them will jump. The leading guys, I suppose, will go down on one knee and elongate the tongue and do the actions. I mean, they're always trying. They did a fabulous one. They brought out one new haka last year. Not a lot of people would have seen it. It was before the South African match in the Tri Nations. Absolutely brilliant. In the end, the last one wasn't a jump. It was the slicing of the throat. Now, I don't think they were going to do that when they come to Ireland after all the Speargate, but it was absolutely fantastic. And for anybody travelling to New Zealand in the rugby season, I tell them this: go to a school's rugby match over there, because if you go to two Maori boys schools, say in Auckland or in the North Island, and see the hakas done by the schools, every school has their different haka, and that's what people don't realise. The haka that you see on the television, the rugby, is an abbreviated sort of washed down version of a thousand different hakas, each from different tribes, and all schools will have a different type of haka. And when you see a whole school of, say, 500 Maori boys doing it against the other school, it's absolutely something to see. And I always say to people, whether you're a rugby lover or not, and to any listeners out there, if they're going to New Zealand, even as a visit, and you can take in a top schools match, do it, because it's an eerie feeling. It'll send goose pimples up your spine. It's absolutely brilliant.
Now, if I could bring you back to 1987, when New Zealand won the World Cup, you missed out with the injury. Now, talk to us again about the disappointment of it, and did that finish your career? And it is the Webb Ellis Cup. Tell us about exactly who was Webb Ellis.
Well, Webb Ellis was the guy that, of course, picked up the ball and ran in rugby school. That's where it all started. Webb Ellis was the guy that they were playing football, effectively kicking the ball. He picked up a ball and ran. I think those days rugby was played by about 200 a side. So they were played in the schools. 200 people against 200 young kids, and he picked up the ball and ran. Of course, he was deemed to be a cheat in those days, because this was football and you were goals, and he scored the ball on the line. That's how rugby started. So William Webb Ellis was the starting place for rugby. Huge disappointment for me, because I'd come from a small rural town. I probably remain the best known rugby player in my kind of school, which was a small kind of, I suppose, in that day, community rural school. To have gone as far as that situation, you know, to be in your own country with the World Cup, to now look back and say that was the only time that ever won it, was quite hard. I took a long time to get over that injury. It was a bad injury. I did come back and play for Otago for another 3 or 4 years after that, and ended up, we won the national championship. They've only ever won it twice, which was a huge event for the city, Dunedin. It was ticker tape parades and everything. I was subsequently named in kind of other All Black 15s and touring sides, but I never had the chance to play like in a World Cup. But then again, you know, I look back on that now. I got to a stage at 29 years of age. I was asked to try it for another All Black tour. I got a phone call at the very same time. Would I come to Ireland? I thought, I weighed it up. I'd always loved Ireland. I'd always wanted to come over here. I'd been over here a couple of times on kind of holiday. I thought, right, if not now, then when? You know, and I was only coming over originally for 3 months. That was it, and I was going to go back home then.
What was your height and weight when you were fighting?
My ideal playing was about 6'3". My ideal playing weight was at about 111 kgs, which I suppose is about 17.5 stone. That would have been my ideal playing weight. You know.
What brought you to Ireland then?
Well, I just got a call. I got a call in the middle of the night. I was in proper evaluation. Those days, of course, remember, the game wasn't professional. It was an amateur. So you worked a day's work and you went away and did your training. And, I mean, you had to take time off work to go to All Black trials or New Zealand games. And that, you know, it was all part of it. And I was in the property. I had my own property evaluation business. And I suppose, for the want of a better word, I was stressed out and I wanted to see the world. A lot of my friends had gone on what we call the Big OE. New Zealanders, Australians traditionally leave home very early, unlike Ireland. You would leave home at 15 or 16 years of age.
Unlike Ireland is right.
Unlike Ireland, not tied to your mother's apron strings. There'll be a lot of Kerry mothers saying, geez, we can get rid of
it. My own wife might even be listening.
So you leave home very early and you go off to university. And this is just about how all New Zealand youth kind of works. You go off to university, you go studying apprenticeship or what are you doing. You get to the age of about 21 or 22. Then you go on what is called the Big OE, which is the overseas experience. And you,
which the Irish are doing from this end.
Yeah, from this end, absolutely. And they go into Australia and you know, the OE for the Irish, when I first came over here, was only New York. That was New York.
Right, yeah.
Now it's Australia is the big place, and even New Zealand. So ours was London. You went to London or you went to the States. Now, I lived and played in rugby in San Diego, and then I also was in London. And I came over to Ireland. I loved Ireland. I spent a new year down in Connemara there, absolutely loved it. So when I got the chance to go over, I said, right, I'm going to go over 2 or 3 months. I absolutely loved Ireland when I first arrived over, and that's what kept me. It's the people. People say to me, down here around Kerry is very similar to New Zealand, very similar to where I grew up.
The mountains are similar, aren't they? Beautiful. Yeah, kind of high rolling, kind of exactly. Greenery. Well,
I said to someone, we're driving up from Cork, and I said to someone, you know what? I said, this is so like New Zealand, it's unbelievable. Looking at the rolling, a few sheep scattered around, I mean, plenty of space, plenty of greenery. So it sort of took me home. It's quite emotional for me to be driving down, and I love it down here for that reason. It could be New Zealand. But I just love the people. I love the history of Ireland. I love the fact that you can call into church. You see, New Zealand's only 200 years old or thereabouts. We have a great history in the sense of the Polynesian culture, of the Maori culture, which I really have embraced over the last few years. I probably didn't grow up because I'm not Maori. I didn't grow up, but a vast proportion of our population are. And I really took that on board is what I love about New Zealand. But over here in Ireland, I love the fact you can call into a church or a building and a thousand years old. I still can't fathom that. And I love looking at ruins and I love following Irish history and the crack.
Brent, that's a very good point, because a lot of us here now wouldn't appreciate the fact people coming from Australia and New Zealand that they'd be so taken up with old buildings and history and things, but you haven't got that history.
No, we haven't. We've got new buildings. I mean, you might go to an old wooden church and they might say, oh, it's 150 years old. I turn and say, my house in Dublin's nearly 150 years old. Yes, yeah. But I mean, I can't stop. If I go to them, I'll always pull into the side of the road and I'll look and I'll jump out of the car and I'll walk around if there's any ruins or something like that and I want to find out, because to me that's so alien and I love that. And I'm still fascinated by that.
You like Kerry?
I do. I love Kerry because it is New Zealand.
And of course,
you
have a Kerry man sitting in with you on the panel on a regular basis, Conor O'Shea.
Oh, Conor O'Shea, yeah.
Conor O'Shea. Do you know that Conor O'Shea's father is a legendary Kerry footballer?
Yeah. I did know that because he tells me.
Yeah. And 50 years ago this year, his father played with Kerry when they won the All Ireland 55. And Dublin were playing against Kerry.
Yeah.
And his father is Joram O'Shea, who would be a good friend of mine. And when Dublin were attacking, there were 2 points, Kerry were 2 points up at the time up, and a big high ball came into the square Joram O'Shea went up and he caught it under the bar and he saved the day. It's still legendary, but every year he's gone 6 inches higher to catch the ball.
Yeah.
So since 1955 now, he's catching the ball 2 feet over the bar.
2 feet over the bar.
So that's Conor O'Shea.
That's the stuff of legends, isn't it?
That's Conor O'Shea's dad now. Yeah, that's Conor O'Shea's. Anyway, Brent, when you came to Ireland, then how did you get involved in the analysis and how did you get involved in the TV?
Well, I was doing the...
How did you actually first get involved?
Well, I was doing the rugby. I was playing for St Mary's at the time, and of course, I was infamously sent off in probably the biggest club game of all time.
Tell us about it.
Which was it was St Mary's versus Young Munster, and of course, the Young Munster side of that has always been deemed to be the greatest kind of club. So certainly out of the Munster region, I mean, the likes of Peter Clossacy, Gerry Earls, you know, legends of the game still remain so in Young Munster. Of course, St Mary's would have been deemed a bit sort of, I suppose, Dublin 4-ish, a bit sort of soft underbelly.
Snobbish.
A bit snobbish, yes, you know, a bit like that. So we were meant to play Young Munster at home. The way that the season worked then was you played, it was just one game. It wasn't home and away. It was just that, you know, you played certain amounts of games away, then you came home. So as it turned out, just in that particular year, we were due to play Young Munster at home. And our capacity of our ground was only about, St Mary's was only about, say, 6,000 or 7,000 at the most. I think Young Munster got on the phone and said, well, look, we're bringing 17,000 people ourselves and we're coming in regardless. So in the end, they transferred the game to Lansdowne Road. Now, it was the best club game ever. I mean, in terms of the numbers of people, it's what people always hark back to as the way club rugby should be and how they remember it. But unfortunately, I got tangled up with another GA, Francis Brosnahan, who was a well-known GA guy in Munster. We get on great now, myself and Frankie, but there was a few fisticuffs and he lay on the ground with a broken jaw and I was sent for the field. It was something that I regretted, but I mean, it was a bit like, I suppose, the Brian O'Driscoll was something. It's something that happened on the spur of the moment, and rugby was a man's game, and there was a flurry of punches, and I never stood off that side of the game. That was, you know, you grew up. I remember my first game as about a 16-year-old in senior rugby in New Zealand. I tried jumping off the shoulder in a line out of a guy who was probably about my age. He was in his 40s, and I sort of thought I'd be a bit of a smart aleck and get the better of him. And I remember he looked at me and he said, you do that once more, son. He said, I'm going to break your nose. And I said, there's no good just talking about it. What do you think happened next? Broke my nose. And I remember going off the field thinking, why did I say that? But that's how you grew up in New Zealand rugby. And when I first come over here, Young Munster especially in Limerick, were a tough side. They were tough men, and that's the way they respected it. And I mean, that's the way I played the game. So the inevitable happened, and I was unfortunately sent off, and we lost. Young Munster went on probably to have their greatest day in club rugby, and I'm great to be a part of the history of that.
What suspension did you get?
I got in those days, I think I might have got 3 months or something.
Did you get into the how did the TV come around then?
Well, the TV came around then that I suppose I was sort of galvanising myself as, I suppose, a bit of a name in the rugby circles, you know, sort of player of the day awards, I suppose, that situation. And then I got asked to come in, as I said, and do and cover a match with Mick Doyle then in a programme called Rugby After Dark. We sat up there with Mick, and lovely guy Mick, and really missed the guy, you know, great storyteller, and would sit up all night.
Great carry man.
Great carry man. You know, I would sit up with Mick all night. He'd sit there with his whiskey. I'd sit there beside him listening to all the stories of great Irish tours. And that's the other thing I love about the Irish people, great storytellers, you know. So then it just sort of, it steamrolled from there, and they kept ringing up and saying, would I come in and do a match? And I was quite surprised how easily I was taken to by the Irish people. I felt a wee bit alien for a start, because I thought, you know, even though I'm a New Zealander, even though I'm over here, and I was one of the original New Zealanders to come over and kind of stay around. There were a lot of people came over, maybe played a couple of games and went. But I stayed, and I think that was kind of, in the end, that was my kind of strength, that people said, okay, well, we know Brent's been here 6 or 7 years.
As I said originally, I was going to ask you about how were you taken, a New Zealander coming in, telling us, yeah, what we are doing wrong with our rugby, and how we should be playing our rugby, and if you like, criticising our rugby players.
Well, you had to. You had
how
to.
Was all that taken by the general public? Was there any kickback?
There was at the start, because people didn't know me, and I suppose people hadn't met me. They kind of said, who is this guy? So what, he's played top-level rugby in New Zealand, but that doesn't mean anything to us. You know, he doesn't know the Irish system, the Irish psyche. But over the years, I did know the Irish psyche, and I had played with all the internationals. I mean, you know, going back to when I first started playing rugby over here, and have been involved in rugby at the sort of either at the playing and at the coaching level. So I saw all the players. I saw the Anthony Foley start their careers. I saw the McGorways. I saw all these players. And I knew them personally, and also knew their strengths and weaknesses. And I suppose, you know, I'd always tried to be, I'm not, you know, maybe to my detriment, sometimes people would say, I'm not controversial, but I don't want to be controversial for the sake of being controversial. You know, I know the strength. It's all very well for other pundits to come on and say, you know, get rid of him or sack him.
Do you avoid being controversial?
I don't avoid being controversial. I just think that you have to have played at a certain level to know the psyche of players. You know, it's easy to say drop a player. It's easy for someone that's never played to say, oh, get rid of him, or, you know, he's got to come in, or make a change at 9 or 10, you know.
Are you saying, Brent, that people analysing games, irrespective of what game it is, that haven't played the game themselves at a fairly top level, and I would go along with you here, in fairness, that they wouldn't have the same insight as the man who played.
No, they don't. They may have an insight. You get the rare statistician, I suppose, who knows a lot about the game, and I respect those guys. I mean, and they write very well on rugby. I'm just talking about maybe when you're sitting and watching an international, and you know, because you've been in that situation, what the players are going through. You know that they're trying. You know that, okay, I can sit there on Saturday and criticise the Irish lack of skill, absolutely, because I believe in this country that Irish players, international and below, don't practice their skills enough.
But you're not criticising it really, because it's a fact.
It's a fact, exactly. So I don't want to be, there are some pundits or some people make their name, as you know yourself, on being controversial, and that is fine for them. I mean, that is great. But I mean, at the end of the day, I think they're probably always looking for a negative rather than the positive. I'm a great believer, and I've sort of turned my whole philosophy of rugby. I suffered a little bit as a rugby player, lack of self-belief, simply because I come from a small country town and nobody had kind of told me that suddenly I'd be locking horns and playing against some of the best players in the world. And I suffered a lot from, oh, I shouldn't even be out there. You know, what am I doing in the company of these greats? And it was only when I played with them, you know, the likes of Buck Shelver playing against the French or the English, I started thinking, like a lot of top GAA players, these guys aren't as good as
do you suffer from self-belief when you're on the TV?
I don't. I was always quite a negative kind. Even when I was coaching for the first few years, I was quite negative in a sense. I'd say, oh, well.
Who did you coach?
I coached St Mary's. We won the national championship. Only Leinster Leinster side, only Dublin side, Leinster side to ever won it. I coached them. I coached Clontarf on the north side, brought them up from the fourth division to the first division. So I've been very successful coaching-wise, but I changed my philosophy on coaching, and I tell you why, because I just don't think there's any sense in being negative. You know, and I see so many coaches, and it's probably GAA included as well, that go in and say, you know, you did this wrong, you did that wrong, you did that. But what does it achieve? You know, absolutely nothing. Because the next time that player goes out, he's going to be nervous. And I've heard coaches saying, you're useless under the high ball. Well, what's going to happen the next time he's under a high ball? He's going to get the jitters and he's going to be useless. So in that sense, what sort of, I suppose, annoyed me a wee bit about the Irish performance last week, I believe they were intimidated before the whistle started. And we saw it last year in the Grand Slam against France. We've seen it when the English come over before, that suddenly this mentality of, oh, well, you know, geez, we don't really think we can win this one. You know, you might as well lose by 20 points as lose by 2, in my opinion.
You honestly think that they were intimidated before the game started?
Yeah, and I think if you watch the way, if you watch the way that game started, absolutely. And I think if you look at the way that game started, I think players looked to be hanging off tackles. No one went in and put a big hit in on the All Blacks and said, well, take a bit of this, you're in our territory now, you know. You know, that sort of side of it is what I respected about the likes of Keith Wood. And to that other extent, another Cork guy, Roy Keane. There's a lot been said about Roy Keane, but as far as I'm concerned, I mean, you know, what he did or what he didn't do, he did bring a professionalism in Irish sport above the normal level, above the situation. Hey, we're not just here in the World Cup to compete. We're here to win it. Keith Wood was the same. Brian O'Driscoll the same. These guys have an attitude. Keith Wood especially was a guy who said, hey, he stood up after that game and would have been refreshing in an interview and say, we weren't good enough. We were blown away. Unless we sort this out, it's going to happen again. Instead of, I suppose, the old usual excuses rolled out, you know, well, we gifted them some soft tries and you know, we didn't start and the tackle was illegal. I thought, you know, get off the soapbox and you know.
And of course, your co-analyst, George Hook, you're a well-known pair, as the fellow says now.
The Muppets.
Would he be the opposite to you now in your view? Like, he can be fairly critical, like, and he's a man that he even quotes scripture in relation to Irish rugby. He can quote any. Come here. What don't you like about George Hook?
George and I get I like George. George is a very well-read
what
man.
What don't you like about every analyst that sits in with somebody else? There's something about the other person did.
Well, George probably the fact that I think that he can be, you know, and it's not sitting on the fence here. Don't get me wrong. I'm quite prepared. I think he can be critical for the sake of being critical, if you know what I mean. You know, that people have come to expect them now to be controversial, to rubbish players. That, I suppose, if he feels that it's not being done, then there's something wrong with the program.
I often get the impression that you cringe a little bit.
I do cringe a bit because, I mean, you can talk about someone, you can say that Anthony Foley was rubbish and he's this, that and the other thing. Hold on a minute. You know, the guy's got 50 caps under his belt, you know.
You're also guilty by association.
Well, I'm guilty by association. Oh, absolutely guilty by association. You know, I mean, and that's the thing that sometimes I find hard because, I mean.
Does it bounce back in you?
Oh, it does bounce back. Absolutely, yeah. I mean, you would be out sometimes and you would see the players and you think, oh, you know, geez, what am I in for now?
Would you avoid them?
I would. Yeah, I wouldn't. I think you've got to. And it's the same as a coach. And I often go around, I do talks a bit, I suppose, of motivational stuff in the sense of coaches. And the one thing I'd say for young coaches is you have to be aloof. Some of them don't want to be, and they'll be seen having a few drinks with the players. No, I would talk to them, and I know a lot of them, and you know, I know a lot of them personally and get on well with them, but I would go to the other end of the bar.
Do you find, Brent, that when you are out and if you got involved with a number of players, that they're a bit wary about what they speak to you about? They're not as open.
No, definitely not. And they're looking at you with one cocked eye.
You feel a bit uneasy. Yeah,
because they don't know that, and it's something I would always respect because I do a bit of writing for the Evening Echo in Cork there, and it's something that they always are looking at you with a third eye thinking, hold on a minute, is this going to be thrown up to me on the TV in 3 weeks' time? Well, I was talking to Ronan Gower and he said this. Nobody wants to be in that situation. No rugby player does, and they have to be very guarded.
Did you ever make a remark that you really regretted?
That's a tough one. No, I don't think so, because I'm very, unlike a lot of pundits, I'm very off the cuff. You know, when you go into RT, they want, see, George will be a meticulous planner. I'm not.
You're after,
I want to see a match, and it's I always watch matches behind the post, like a lot of GAA. I would stand behind the post. I would like to think that I have a quite a good peripheral vision of the game. You know, I like to see, now this is what they do. I don't want to pre-record it. I don't know what's going to happen. You know yourself in a game, as soon as the whistle starts, as soon as the kickoff goes, anything can happen in any sport. I don't like to have it pre-planned in a sense that, okay, this is what might happen, this is what I think will happen. I want a clean slate. I'm going to go in there at the end of the game at halftime. I'm going to say, right, this is what I've seen. That's just the way I do it. George is a little bit different. He's very meticulous planning, and fair play to him for that. I'm just not. I would rather go in. If somebody said to me, look, come in for 3 days, you know, research this, research that, I would say, no, look, I would just rather take... Now, I know the players and I know their history, probably because I keep up with the game. I'm watching Super 12, I'm watching Tri Nations, you know, I'm watching all the Six Nations on Sky.
What's the most difficult part of your job as an analyst? How long are you at it, by the way?
10 years.
10 years. What's the most difficult part of it?
The most difficult part of, well, the pronunciation of, like, the Fijians' names or whatever you get sometimes. The most difficult point, I suppose, and analysts, and people don't realise this, is we don't have much time. And what might happen, say you've got 5 tries in a match. Now, during the ad break, which is only about a minute long, that has gone, the try might have happened in the first minute, and it's quite hard for you. Things have gone on, other things have come on. So your analysis piece comes up that you've taken. You quite often don't get a chance to watch that. And, you know, through the jigs and the reels sometimes, it might not be exactly what you called for, and suddenly you're on, and you've got this. Oh, I've got this worked out. You know, Driscoll to Horgan, the kick, the try. Suddenly, it's not the right thing, and you're thinking, now what happened exactly? That's the hardest thing, and you can sometimes come across to people that don't know is, you know, geez, what's he talking about? That didn't happen, because they're only focused on one thing. We have to go the whole time. You've got to watch the match. You've got to watch for individual players. You've got to watch for things happening. And you've also got to have a mental picture of what you want to try to go over in, say, 2 or 3 minutes. And George does the majority of the talking. Yeah. I don't get much talk. By the time Hook is finished, I'm only on for about a minute or so. So I've got to be pretty succinct in what I'm saying, I suppose.
You mentioned Pat Spillane there a while ago, Ron Pat Spillane. He went from the analyst side of it to the other side of the table, as the fella said, and he's the presenter. Would you like to be a presenter?
I've tried it. I would in some regards. I think Pat's brilliant because I've met Pat a good few times. He's one of the wittiest guys I've met. I mean, Pat's ability as a presenter is that he can be off the cuff. I mean, I think Pat is the ideal presenter in that sense because he's got so much sharp sort of witticisms that he can come out with something like that. I would feel I'm better employed on the other side. Although I'd be
actually
quite
Pat is probably better employed on the other side too as an analyst.
Yeah, because I mean my strength would probably be interviewing rugby players as such because I know enough about the game and I would know enough about their, like if John Alomu or Zinzan Brook or Sean Fitzpatrick, I could sit like you're talking to me and say, well, look, remember back in whatever. So that's strength of it. Being on TV like Tom McGurk, no, or like Pat, no, probably. I would prefer to have the questions directed at me.
A simple yes or no, and that's the only answer you're going to give me to this. Is it a well-paid job?
No, it's not. And people speculate about that, and I remember a few years ago actually ringing RTE because my photo was put alongside Eamon Dumfries or something, and there was a big, I think it was 150,000 splash these guys get a year. But no, absolutely not. And I rang RTE straight away, and I said, look, I said, I want this to be known. I don't want to see people, you know, I drive around a 98 Passat. I don't want people thinking, you know, this guy is making money. I do it for the love of it. You know, if you took the fact that we work 30 weekends a year, the money is very small. I do it because I love it. I love the fact that, you know, I still get a kick out of, people say to me, I still get a kick out of coming somewhere. Like I was down here last night and went to a couple of pubs and I met a few GA guys. They come over and shake hands. I love meeting people.
GA lads that were drowning their sorrows after losing a county
celebrating
final.
Celebrating their loss. But they were good
in Killarney, yeah. But you had a good time with them.
Which was brilliant. And it's no bother to me. It would be no bother to me to go over and have a photo because I feel privileged. If I go over to New Zealand and Irish people come over the Lions tour and they're chanting your name on the street and that, to me, I pinch myself every moment. When that stops, I'll be thoroughly upset. Because I love it.
Seeing that you're here in Kerry, of course, naturally enough, rugby wouldn't be the big sport in Kerry, but it is a big sport in Kerry. Now, let me put it like that. And of course, by the way, when I mention Mick Galway, I must send my sympathies to his family and to Mick and the recent death of his mother. Mick Galway, Mas Keen, you spoke about Mick Dyle and his brother Tommy Dyle. Yep. They are the names, and of course the Springs.
Yeah,
the Springs would be associated with Irish rugby too. Kerry and Robbie Brent.
Yeah, what are your... and all wonderful people. It's just when we can't understand you. That's the. I take a little tour out. I'm putting something back into the grassroots game. I take a tour out to New Zealand every year called the Shamrocks, and it's for people from non-traditional rugby areas. We get a lot of GAA guys going over. I put them over to New Zealand for nearly 6 or 7 weeks. Have ex-All Blacks, a friend of mine, coming down and coaching me. And we've had a couple of Kerrymen. Remember, I think I'm not too sure where Humphrey Shanahan was named, but all I could understand him was saying was right good now. You know, that was all.
Can you understand Muskeen talking?
No, not. Even the GAA guys last night, I had to listen with a cocked ear because I remember when we came.
Well, I tell you, buy his book, Rock Smalls and Gaelic Football, because you won't have to listen to it. You can read it. Read it. Do you know, we're pushing on and we can stay talking till the cows come home, as the fella said. If you were Irish manager in the morning, what tactics would you change or what would you do to improve?
Well, what I would do for a start is I think this Irish team, I think that Eddie O'Sullivan must make changes now, you know, and I think that... What would you do? I would start making changes. I mean, I'm not at the coal face of the game now, but I mean, there are a certain number of players there that are young guys. I think they've got to start shifting through the gears and getting some young guys into the team. I think there's some guys that are the ripe side of 30 or getting close, have probably finished their rugby careers. They probably admit it themselves, although they don't want to be told. I think if you're looking to the World Cup, and remember, every coach now, like football, fortunately, or not, that they're now aspiring to do as well in the World Cup on the world stage. So Eddie O'Sullivan should have probably, the team should have won the Grand Slam last year, and that will be a huge disappointment for them because Wales were no better side. They just managed to sort of play an attacking game, and I think you'll probably find that Ireland will beat Wales this year and probably do okay. But on a world stage, you've got to get some new blood in there. Ulster are producing a few of their own. I mean, there's players down here that they have to look around the country for young 19, 20, 21-year-old guys. Dip them into the international scene and let them have a go.
Because, so you'll bring in younger blood.
Definitely.
I can't let you go without talking about you're a journalist in your own right, and you write and you do a lot of work for charity. And one of the works you do is you write books for charity. And one book is even after called George Hook, isn't it? Now, what do you do, Brent? You write children's.
I write children's book. I've had that just briefly. That started in New Zealand, and I was working with my property business. I had a secretary had a little girl, unfortunately, with leukemia, about 8 years of age. And just briefly, she loved sharks, dolphins, a bit like the fungi or whatever. She loved all that whales. She just loved. So I started drawing and writing books and sending them down, photocopies of them to the hospital. A doctor contacted me and said, look, will you send another 100 or 200 copies because the kids love them. So a publisher contacted me and we ended up publishing the books. And I said, well, look, all the money would go to the Child Cancer Society in New Zealand. I did two over New Zealand, sold remarkably well, become sort of, I suppose, cult books. I didn't do anything then for about 6 or 7 years, and I was back in New Zealand about 3 years ago, and somebody said, look, the books were fantastic. Do you ever think of doing them again? So I came back over here. I did a book entitled Woody, A Whale of a Tale, which was about Keith Wood. It was about a whale that got sunburnt, of all things. And I put all the rugby players in it. Brian O'Driscoll was Mayor O'Driscoll. Mick Galway was in it. Was Michelangelo Galway's ice cream. He owned a little ice cream shop. And I...
Seller?
I wouldn't say best. Yeah, well, it got high on the children's books. Yeah. And I did another one, not a non-rugby one, called Arnold the Noseless Anteater, which was a sort of a Dr. Seuss one. I've got one in the publishers now called Bangers and Smash.
Is there a biography in Brent Pope to come out?
I don't know whether people would... You know, I know George. I don't know whether people would read it. You know, I'm not that interesting enough to people to pick up. I mean, I have done a lot of things in my life, like the children's books and the rugby, and I've travelled the world with rugby, and I have a lot of great stories to tell. I just don't know, apart from myself, from appearance.
Are you a religious person?
I am a religious person, yeah. I'm brought up a strict Catholic. My father and mother would both be heavily involved in the Catholic Church in New Zealand still. So, I mean, am I a regular church goer? No, I'd be honest to say I'm not, but I do have a spiritual side and a faith, definitely.
What are your ambitions now?
My ambitions, I suppose, I've gone into new, and that's why we're down here. My ambitions, I've gone into a new sector, which is property now, and I've taken a back step from the rugby coaching. I may go back to that. My ambitions, I suppose, like anybody, is just to I suppose, live a happy life.
What would you say to rugby followers in Kerry and in the surrounding counties beyond, and even in the internet where we go, what would you say to rugby people in Kerry now?
Well, I'd say just to keep the faith, I suppose. I mean, we've had some great days of Irish rugby over the last 5 years. I think we might maybe going possibly into a bit of a depressive state, and that started on Saturday. I just think, I suppose, is to, you know, for those people, is really to enjoy what is the good things about the sport, I suppose, the camaraderie. I mean, a lot of it has been lost on professional sport, and I think you see that in GAA, what I saw last night, and the guys celebrating the loss. To me, that is sport at its greatest. I mean,
Has professional brought...
Dampened that.
It has brought Irish rugby down a bit, Brent?
it hasn't. It's brought them. It's brought them more monetary gain, and it's brought them a more professional approach in the sense of being able to compete. Has it brought them the fun, the camaraderie, the Moskeens, the characters? No, it hasn't. I mean, I don't think you're going to see the likes of those sort of players.
Who's the best Irish rugby player at the moment?
Brian O'Driscoll.
Brian O'Driscoll, yeah.
With the doubt. But who's the best rugby character? You've got to go back. I mean, you've got to go back to the likes of Mossy and these people to see the characters.
They're gone.
They're gone. And they
professional
will
has taken that.
Professional has taken that away from world rugby. I remember days of sitting up, you know, you're sitting up with the opposition team. They've got a couple of smokes going. There's a pint in your hand. There's a sing-song going. It's 3 o'clock in the morning. That, to me, was part and parcel of sport. People would say now that playing professional, that's rubbish. To me, it's not rubbish. To me, that's what sport should be played about.
Well, Brent, I can tell you, we could stay talking because there are men waiting outside to come in and put in a new desk where we're talking here. I want to thank Sean Hurley, who's here in sound, and I want to thank I want to thank our own Fiona Stack of Radio Kerry, who organised this interview. And I tell you the truth, I think we only touched the tip of the iceberg. Bryn Pope, thank you for joining
me. Thank you very much.
On my programme, and the best of luck to you.
Cheers, thank you.